This is the third talk on the theme of seeing more clearly by seeing how we don't see so clearly. And I'm following an identification of five ways that we don't see so clearly, five ways that, in a sense, things are not as they appear to us. And in the first session, 2 weeks ago, we covered the first two. And the first one was we see through the lens of the personal self in often distorted ways. And we explored various ways that this occurs. Very obvious ways that if we have maybe a difficulty with someone, a conflict, we will tend to see what's negative about the person, the situation, and we won't see what's positive. You know, we will, as it were, cherry pick the evidence. It's familiar. We can do this in terms of ourselves, either to make ourselves look good or to make ourselves not look good. And we gave other examples last time, especially just seeing through the lens of self and the practices that we pointed to, because each of these five ways of not seeing so clearly are or can be associated with practices which help us explore that territory. That's really the aim of all this, is to, in a way, give a map, but also practices, so that you can focus on these areas, maybe one area at a time, or come back to look at all of them over a period of time. And the second area that I mentioned was that we see through the lens of social conditioning. Again, obvious in a certain way. And I think the ways that we see through that lens occur in a lot of different ways. Some of it is just at the level of meaning. What we might take to be meaningful is going to be different from someone living in another culture 1,000 years ago. You know, we can look at traffic lights, for example, and we know the meaning of red and yellow and green. If someone somehow was transported from, I don't know, ancient India 2,000 years ago, the meaning of traffic lights would not be obvious. Now, someone bright could probably figure it out pretty soon. But it's not, in other words, we get to learn the meanings of the culture. Right? In very mundane ways as more subtle ways. And there are all sorts of conditioning, ranging from more gross to more subtle. And one of the interesting points that was raised by Ron last time, which I thought was right, was that, in a sense, I'm presenting this order because the first two are ways of having our vision or perception distorted that are not hard to see, or how it's influenced. They're not hard to see. But Ron pointed out that they're actually very easy to see dimensions of these two, as well as very subtle dimensions. And in fact, that led me to reflect that these five ways that things are not quite as they appear are very much interrelated. That I said the first one was we see through the lens of the personal self. Well, they're gross dimensions to that, and that's what I was pointing to sort of get us going with the theme. And same thing with social conditioning, but there are also very subtle levels by which we see through the personal self, and those, in fact, are part of what I identify with the third, fourth, and fifth dimension. So these are interrelated. But I was choosing the first two because aspects of it are more obvious to us. We can see them more easily. And as we get into the third, fourth, and fifth, some aspects are more obvious and some are harder to see. And again, all of these are a way of making very practical and real this core teaching of the Buddha and many traditions, which is that we are not really awake. They use the metaphor of being not awake. What does that mean? And part of the meaning is that we actually don't see things accurately. I gave the quotation, I think, the first time, one of the quotations from the Buddha where he says, warped perceptions are what keep your mind on fire. And so it's actually a very radical, even startling teaching, telling us that our normal way of perception is off in some fundamental ways, and that we're locked into a way of seeing which is actually connected with some dimensions of illusion, illusory in some way. Other parts of the tradition say dreamlike in some way. And that's not how we usually look at things, is it? We usually walk around saying, Donald here, Corey here, trees, bay, lectern, lights, or speakers, I should say. And that's ordinary. That's our ordinary orientation. And I'll come back and talk some about why that is. But let's say the third one we looked at last time is related. It's that we tend not to see impermanence clearly. And again, I'll say more, come back to why we do this. Some of it's the influence of language and conceptualization. Large part is, actually. But we don't see how things are changing as much as they are changing. We are tending to see things as solid and more or less permanent in our ordinary perception. And so some of the practices that we did in the guided meditation and that we did last time are pointing to how we might come to see things not as much through the lens of conceptualization and be able to see change more closely. And so the guided practice took us first to notice impermanence actually by using concepts, noticing arising, staying, changing, passing away. That's helpful, that's important. But then in the latter part of the meditation, I invited you to let go of the conceptualization and just be with the flow of experience. Now today I'm going to go into the fourth one, so we're getting more advanced. So fasten your seatbelt. The fourth of these is that we tend to see solid selves and solid objects that are permanent where there are not such independent, separate, permanent selves and objects. And then the fifth is, again, these are interrelated, I think. The fifth is that we tend to have a basic duality of self and everything else that, when we look carefully, dissolves. So there isn't this fundamental duality, and in fact, a sense of non-duality is closer to the truth of our experience than duality. And yet the conditioning is very strong. So today, I want to look at the fourth one, and I want to look at just part of it, really, which is to look at the sense of independent, separate self that we have. That when we look around, there seem to be a lot of separate beings, right? And I seem to be an independent, separate self. And yet we also know in the teachings that the Buddha is saying has this fundamental mysterious teaching of anatta, or not self, which we've explored at times, you know, here. But we'll come back to it. And he's basically saying we don't see ourselves accurately. We see inaccurately through concepts and compulsions. Again, a potentially startling and even disorienting teaching, right? So how do we understand this? And I'll go back to first looking at this from the standpoint of understanding, and then I'll look at it more from the point of view of meditations that help us to open up this way of seeing. So again, it's I think what I'm trying to do with all of these is to both give a map of sorts of the territory, and then also point to how we might investigate this experientially through our meditations, which are pretty much just the following the guided meditations that we've done. You follow those, do those a lot, this territory will open up. And they're not difficult meditations, right? It's just that one has to keep on doing them. Yeah. And I'll come back to that because there's an interesting sequence of meditations that really move from our starting point as meditators, just developing stability of mind, seeing what's there in our experience and so forth, all the way to more subtle ways of seeing beyond the structures of self and even the structures of independent, permanent phenomena. Okay? So this is getting into a really interesting but not beginning territory, right? And it can be very interesting. So I'll start by the map, and this will be talking more conceptually to give you a sense, including using reference to Western ways of understanding, including science, neuroscience, and so forth, why it is that we tend to see selves and objects as independent, separate, and permanent. And the short answer is, it's because all of our experience is structured by representation, concepts, and models. That's the short answer. And that's pretty much what the cognitive sciences tell us, right? That we may have a naive view that we're looking at reality. And in fact, psychology and science used to have that naive view. They used to have the view that there's kind of a world out there. Our perception produces a little picture of the independent world of objects, and we send that picture onto the brain to organize things. That used to be the model in psychology. But that's not the model now. The model, there was kind of a revolution which shows that there's a way that we structure the very data kind of right from the beginning. And I think, did I talk about the frog last time? Okay. There's a famous study which shows how frogs do this. They used to think that frogs and humans were pretty similar, that in some ways. And that there was basically that frogs saw an independently existing world, had a kind of picture of it, and maybe in a less sophisticated way, sent on information to the brain to be processed. But when they actually studied the perception of the frog, they found it doesn't work like that. And this is a famous study which was done, I don't know, 40 years ago or so. Some of you may have read the study. It's called What the Frog's Eye Tells the Frog's Brain. Anyone study that? Maybe somebody. I studied in college, I think. And what they essentially find is that frogs have four kinds of perception. they don't perceive trees and Corey, you know, and Nick and Mary. I hope that's okay. So they don't perceive you. They have four kinds of perceptions. When you hear about them, this is what the researchers found. One perception, this is a perceptual category. Okay, this is basically the frog's eye, as it were, perceives four types of things. One of them is something very small moving around quickly. Right? What's that? A fly. Something. It, you know, it's basically. Whoop. It's basically supper. See, if the frog was looking at this, maybe some of it would, I don't, would Corey be seen as a small little thing moving around quickly? No. But another category that frogs see is something big coming over the field. Danger. Basically, you know, the first kind of perception triggers, you know, quick movements of the tongue, let's say. And the second kind of perception triggers, whoop, out of there. Or maybe it was Corey, would be the other way, right? And so, anyway, to make a long story short, this is essentially what a frog perceives, and humans do it in a much more sophisticated way, but our perception is occurring through concepts and models, a lot of which have to do with the culture, some of which have to do with our past history, but essentially, we have a kind of interaction with the world. We don't simply pick up the world as it is. That was an earlier model, which was an early model of science as well, called positivism. Some of you know that term, you know, where the idea was there's an independently existing world and science brings us reality because science gives us a picture of the world. You know, we get evidence about the world as it really is and we build up knowledge and that's science. People who understand science these days don't have that model at all. Interesting, isn't it? Right? And so what we actually do is through our concepts, we have numerous models of all sorts, models, metaphors, shorthands that affect our perception and affect our thinking. And again, as I think I mentioned last time, 98% of our thinking is unconscious. So most of this is happening beneath the level of consciousness. In other words, we see the world through interpretive lenses, you know, which some of which are personal, some of which are cultural. I remember I was very struck by this. Again, I think I was in college and I read a book which was very influential in the field. It was called The Social Construction of Reality. Does anyone remember that book? Yeah, it was by, I looked it up. I think I still have it. It was by Peter Bergman and Thomas Luckman. And it basically showed how the world is constructed. Now, there's nothing wrong with this. In fact, this is, I think, how humans have to operate. Now, what's interesting, though, is that having used concepts and models and metaphors to construct the world, we're not aware that we've constructed it. Again, the constructions obviously have a lot of use. It's very helpful for me to know my name, you know, and say that's my car, you know. Very useful for us to share models of the world to a large extent, right? So the main issue that Buddhists will have is that we see through our representations and models, we see through the world through our constructions, but we don't realize we're doing that. and that it's actually possible to see the world without constructions. That's the short version of the message. And I'm going to use the famous Buddhist concept of emptiness to make some sense of this. Because emptiness, which is a very confusing term, it's a central term in early Buddhism and even more central in later Buddhism, could be understood as meaning simply a construction. It says, selves are empty. Phenomena are empty. They're empty of independent inherent existence. Another way to say that is they're simply constructed. Everything is constructed. But again, unless we go into meditation, we actually, you know, if you're a psychologist, one knows experientially that everything is constructed, and there are whole fields. One of the major fields in psychology these days is called constructivist psychology, right? Again, many of you know this. And there's a sense that the self is constructed, the world is constructed, perception occurs through constructions. And they know that intellectually, but experientially they still work with the constructions. And so this is kind of the map of the territory. And so Buddhists have the same understanding, interestingly. And for them, though, it's actually important to know the meaning of seeing everything as a construction experientially, not just intellectually. You know, why is that? It's essentially because we grasp onto what we think is permanent. And particularly, we grasp onto self. And we don't see phenomena, and we don't see the selves as being quite so impermanent, changing, constructed. And so we fight wars based on constructions that aren't ultimately real, right? That are models, but we think that they're real. And so, in other words, there's a whole lot of suffering connected at times with constructions. On the other hand, constructions of an ordinary kind are useful, and we shouldn't particularly get rid of them. But the whole aim of practice is to learn how to see beyond constructions. And that's taken to actually be connected with liberation. So it makes sense so far? And so the meditations that we're doing are very simple meditations that help us to look into how things are constructed. A lot of what we do in our meditation is we learn how to experience in a way which is less mediated by concepts. And I think most of us have some taste of that, right? We learn how to see a sunset without the concept so much, which is beautiful, wonderful. Maybe without self-orientation, I can see the sunset without having my concept say, what a wonderful sunset, look at that sunset, oh, look at that color, look at this. We can learn, especially if we have good meditative training, to see, so to speak, a sunset, and I'm using that in a rough way, because in a strict way, we don't see a sunset. You know, there's some experience of forms, colors, shapes, and so forth. But we learn increasingly how to experience without being so ruled by concepts. One of the ways we learn that is by simply developing concentration. We learn how to be with the breath, for example, and hang out with the breath, and increasingly have that be not conceptually mediated. I'm just with the sensations of the breath. As we deepen in concentration, we come into a way of experiencing which is much less mediated by concepts. And the way the meditation works is that we start by having some conceptual mediation, and we move towards essentially conceptualization winding down. And so there's a whole simple developmental pathway in meditation. So for example, my beginning in meditation is what? I start by being aware of the breath. I might say in and out. I might be distracted 3/4 of the time. I come back to the breath. I see where I'm distracted. And over time, the percentage of time with the breath gets higher. It goes from maybe 2% at the beginning to 5% to 10% to 20% to 50%. When we're at 50%, we're starting to know all the different ways we conceptualize. And I know, oh, there's my story about my finances. Oh, that's coming up again, okay? We see it near the beginning. We see other extended stories near the beginning. I have a sense of my top 5, my top 10, right? I notice them, and I am able to notice them more quickly. If I do a retreat, I may start to have times when the conceptualization is considerably wound down to maybe 70% of the time with the object, 80%, 90%, even sometimes periods of time when there's no conceptualization, at least of a gross kind. We can still be having a kind of more subtle conceptualization where I'm saying in and out, or then I'm doing mindfulness and I'm noticing sound, sensation, which helps me to track. So we use concepts to help us wind down the concepts, right? We do that. We use concepts in our meditation. I say thinking, I say planning, and that helps me not to be so bound by the concepts, right? So interestingly, we use the active conceptual mind to help us have the potential of being free of the conceptual mind. Again, the aim here is not to get rid of the conceptual mind, but it's not to be ruled by it. It's not to be ruled by it. So my personal experience is that I think much less than I did when I first started meditating. Way, way, way less. Better quality. Okay, so we have that sense of the first parts of meditation, we're winding down conceptualization, and we then might start to open up to a time when the conceptualization gets lighter. Maybe I'm, again, we may first experience this on retreats or when we're doing a lot of meditation, and we may have the experience of being with the flow of experience, much like we were just doing. We just did it for 2 or 3 minutes, but I might have the experience of maybe being with the flow of experience for 20 minutes and be able just to stay with sensation. And again, maybe I use mental notes to help me stay with it. Sensation, thinking. But I'll say I start to be able to be just with the flow of experience with very little conceptualization. And I get to a point where I can be just with sensation and even notice the seeds of thinking and conceptualization suddenly just appearing like in the mind, like as little burps, like whoop, and I know, oh, that was going to be financial planning. Yep. I know that. Yeah. And you know that just even though there's just whoop, just a little, like a seed of the thought. Is this making some sense? So there's a way that over time, as we practice, if you stay with it, conceptualization starts to wind down. And again, concentration plays a significant role here. That's why concentration retreats, including metta retreats, are very helpful. So they start to wind down, and we start to be able to have times when we're experiencing without many concepts, or they don't occur very much. And we start to experience the objects, so-called, no longer as objects. So I may be with a tree, and I don't think tree anymore, but it's more the shapes, colors, forms, right? Without conceptualization. And that can, again, can be very interesting. And, you know, I was reflecting that this kind of exploration occurs in meditation. It's also part of the history of modern art. Those of you who've studied art know that, for example, the Impressionists were very interested in getting beyond conventional perception, because they thought that, you know, the art of the 19th century is so much following, this was in, I guess, in France, is so much following just conventions, right? You know, of being realistic, right? This is what you do. And they were interested in going beyond or going beneath conceptualization in their artwork. And so you can look at their work as doing something quite similar to what I was just describing. And so when you have Van Gogh with all those dots, you know, the Starry Night, he's deconstructing ordinary perception. That's what Cézanne is doing in that artwork. You can look at that artwork as being quite parallel in an interesting way to meditation, right? Deconstructing conceptualization and then saying, what does seeing look like when I'm not conceptualizing in the old way? It's interesting, isn't it? And so our meditation does something similar. And we start to be able to have these periods as we deepen. And this is this fourth area. As we deepen, we start to have the experience of phenomena occurring without conceptualization. There's still form, seems to be form, color, you know, different things like that occurring. Eventually, when we go yet deeper, form, color, shape turns into energy and light. That's yet deeper, right? But as we, at this point, I think what we can actually experience some is that we start experiencing without the conceptualization, just the forms, the colors. And again, in our own experience, it could just be I'm with sensations and I'm not conceptualizing. And of course, sensation is not an area of experience where we have a lot of conceptualization. So in a sense, it's easier. It's easier than doing this with our eyes open, looking outside, because we have all sorts of concepts for what's outside. We don't have many concepts for the inner world of sensation. We may have a few, you know, hard, soft, hot, cold, you know, pressure, etc., but not very many. And so at a certain point, we are with the flow of experience without conceptualizing. Could be with sensation, could be with sound, could even be with thoughts and emotions where they just come. And often, when we're at this level, they're coming quite quickly because there's not conceptual development of them. And it is sort of a flow, a quick flow of phenomena without making it into a tree, into me. Now, I haven't focused so much on inner experience. The interesting thing is that the same thing happens with inner experience in terms of, is there a self? We start to see what I call myself. And this was the Buddha strategy. This was the way that the Buddha taught this area. He said, can you look at your inner, can you look, not just inner experience, can you look at your experience and actually notice it as now that, essentially, now there's a sensation. Now there's a sense of liking or disliking. Now there's a thought. Now there's an emotion. You know, now there's an impulse. Can you notice that and be at the level of experience where you're just having the flow of those constituents of experience without any sense of self? And we can experience that in the meditation. Probably some of us did just for a brief time in the guided meditation, right? And that's what the Buddha is pointing to. His main vehicle for learning about this is the teaching of the aggregates or the skandhas, which are essentially what are the five constituents of experience. And, you know, it's a little bit arbitrary. We could have three or we could have six or ten, but it's pretty much what we were just doing. That is, can I just notice thoughts, sensations, emotions, sounds, smells, etc.? Can I notice the different senses occurring without conceptualizing them and without saying, this is mine, this is me, without self-oriented thinking, I like this, I don't like this, commentary, etc.? And this is what the Buddha's pointing to when he talks about anatta or not self. It's not any more complex than this. And in a sense, it's the experiential counterpart of what the psychologists and cognitive sciences are talking about. That we see through representations, which are fine, they're useful, they also can be really damaging, as when the representations are connected with greed, hatred, or delusion. But representations in general have their use, right? But we forget that we're seeing through representations. We live in a sense, just to get a sense, we live in that way in a kind of dream world. That makes more sense now, right? To say, you know, when you first hear that, it sounds kind of a little bit crazy, right? We live, and this way of seeing that I've been presenting is no different from what Buddhists mean by emptiness. Emptiness is a strange term, especially in English. I think it's less strange in the original language. And it's Guy Armstrong did a whole book. If you want to read more, this is a nice, he's a book on emptiness, very full book. And he starts the book by saying, what a strange term for a whole world religion to have as a core concept. Emptiness. It sounds less sexy than bliss, devotion, love, right? But it's really, emptiness in the Buddhist teaching always goes hand in hand with compassion. Emptiness is part of the wisdom teaching. It always goes hand in hand with compassion and care. Because essentially one sees, gosh, look at all these people living in somewhat of a dreamlike state and doing things which lead to suffering. So seeing into emptiness always connects with compassion. Right? But this is all that emptiness means, that we're seeing without the conceptualizing that says, this is real, this is independent, this is solid, this is permanent. That's all that it is. You know, and again, maybe some people like to translate emptiness, the term is shunyata or sunyata in Pali, like to translate it with something like openness or permeability, something like that. That gets at some of the meanings. You know? Didn't look at my notes at all tonight. Let me see if I have anything else. Well, I'll just finish by saying that this is connect with some of what we've explored in other gatherings where I've talked about anatta or not self. The way we study this, the way we really study emptiness, the way we work with this fourth guide is in two ways. And this is kind of typical of our practice. On the one hand, we look at what gets in the way of seeing this in this mode. We look at where there's a strong sense of self, what I've called in the past a thick sense of self. And we just study it. We don't try to get rid of it. We don't judge it. We just say, okay, let me look at where a strong sense of self comes up in my experience and study it. Study it over and over again. That's necessary for being able to let go of it. So I see where there's reactivity. I see where I have self-image, self-consciousness. I see the areas where I tend to think a lot about something. And I look at them and study them. Maybe, you know, partly I may study where they're wounds. And again, some of what we look at where there's a strong sense of self, it's not about getting rid of it or transcending. Sometimes we need to heal that particular area. That's an important addition. I'm being a little brief on this, but there are a lot of subtleties like that. You know, I may have a thick sense of self because of some childhood issue that's still there. Right? And then, I may have that thick sense of, the Buddhist practice, I think, can be confusing if we interpret it as transcending that childhood wound or difficulty. Rather, I think we have to, in order to come to that sense of emptiness, we have to heal that area. One writer, psychologist, Jack Engler, once said, you have to have a full self before you can overcome it or go beyond it. Right? So on the one hand, we look at where there's a thick self. This is our practice. This making it practical. On the other hand, we open up to those experiences of flow, and both in meditation and in daily life, where we can have a sense of the flow of experience with a minimal sense of self, with minimal conceptualization. And what I've often explored here is that that happens more than we think. A lot of things where we feel very competent, we're probably in that flow. And I brought in that term by the psychologist Csikszentmihalyi, right, who talks about flow experience, which occurs a lot for us, I think, when we're with people we really are connected with, in, you know, with sunsets. Happens a lot in sports. It's called being in the zone. Happens in music, in art, all these phenomena, where there's a sense of flow. You know, a jazz musician who's really with the flow of the music, if that jazz musician starts having a lot of self-oriented thoughts, the flow is gone, right? Oh, that was such a cool riff I did. I have to remember that. Right? The moment that happens, it's gone, right? So that, you know, that jazz musician is having very minimal conceptualization, if any, right? Same thing with us, with a lot of experiences. You know, creative experiences are good examples, but I think also sports, sometimes being in with the earth, the natural world, doing things which we really love and are familiar with. We can be with that flow. Could be sometimes being with children. You know? And we can even use concepts in that way. My intention often is just try to teach out of that place, to teach out of that zone, where I'm using concepts, but I'm using them without thinking, in a way, if that makes any sense. Maybe not. Okay, so let me see if I have a closing comment. Okay, this is from the teachings of the Buddha. This is the text, actually. This is called the Emptiness Discourse. Okay. Venerable Ananda went to the Blessed One, that's the Buddha, and on arrival, having bowed down, sat to one side. As he was sitting there, he said to the Blessed One, "It is said that the world is empty. In what respect is it said that the world is empty?" And this is the Buddha's answer. It pretty much will follow what we did in the meditation. "Insofar as it is empty of a self or anything pertaining to a self, it is said that the world is empty. And what is empty of a self? The I is empty of a self. Forms are empty of a self. I consciousness is empty of a self. The ear is empty of a self." So it's going through all the senses, right? "The nose is empty of a self. The tongue is empty of a self. The body is empty of a self. The mind is empty of a self." And so forth. "Thus it is said that the world is empty." So those texts are hard to read when you don't have the very practical, simple experience that we explored. But when you have that experience, the texts make sense, make a little more sense. It's all it is saying, can I be with the constituents of experience without constructing and conceptualizing? That's it. And that when one does that, it opens up further realms of insight and freedom. Okay, so I'll stop and invite a short pause. Yeah, and then invite any comments or questions. I went a little bit over. Maybe I shouldn't have given that quotation. I wanted to have more discussion, but anyway. So we'll use the mic, and we'll start with Patty in the back, and then, and go secondly.
Thank you, Donald. I have two questions. The way you're describing experience without concepts makes me think that even of the five aggregates, only two of them are without concepts, the form and consciousness. Because having a pleasant and unpleasant is a concept, and the mental formation is a concept. So it seems to me that the aggregates that are used to describe the bare experience are themselves constructs.
Right. Yeah, so it's a great point. What I'm pointing to here is that we are winding down conceptualization, and that the skillful means of teaching winds it down in steps. And the model of the aggregates is one skillful mean that helps us to avoid some kinds of conceptualization, but still may have others. So even with form, there can be, we can say long or short. And, or with the, if you remember the text, the Buddha in the text on the foundations of mindfulness talks about, do you know that the breath is long or short, right? But this is winding it down because we're not saying my breath. So there's a gradual winding down of conceptualization, but I think you're right to say that the model of the aggregates itself is not pointing to non-conceptual experience.
Thank you. My other question.
Yeah.
You never said the other two ways the frog sees.
The other two ways of...
You told us that the frog sees four ways and you only told us two of them.
That's true. You know why that is?
No.
It's because I forgot them. I have them written down somewhere, but not with my current notes.
That's your homework.
Huh?
Homework.
Well, I already...
My homework.
Yeah, yeah, but it's... I forget what they are, but you probably can even think it out and it would be kind of obvious. What would they be?
One would be sexual.
Huh?
Sex. Right, something feeling good or sexual.
Right.
That doesn't resonate with my memory, but... So it might be right. Okay. Okay, next time I come back, we'll go with all four. Okay, please.
Yeah. Thanks. I thought that was a really interesting talk and an interesting organization and approach. And it was interesting in part because you didn't use the term non-dual.
Yeah. I pointed to the fifth way of working with this theme as pointing to non-dual experience, but we're not there yet, actually. We're not there yet. We're still, even in perceiving emptiness, there's still a knower and a known. So there's dualistic experience. And that's why I like to see the whole Buddhist path when you look at this, at this level we're looking at in terms of cognition, ways of knowing, perception, that it's a gradual winding down of the habitual consciousness, the habitual mind. But it doesn't do it all at once. That I would say is skillful means. If we went from the, there's some approaches which in the West do that, such as Dzogchen in the Tibetan tradition, but in Tibetan tradition it was never done that way. Dzogchen was done after 8 years of dedicated practice. But in the West, you get this non-dual experience. You can do a retreat without any prerequisites. And I think, it may not be real good skillful means. So here, the skillful means are to kind of gradually take one into the deep territory. But here, we're just trying to, similar to Patty's question, we're kind of winding down some aspects of the ordinary habitual mind sort of one step at a time. And that makes it actually pretty easy to understand when you have a map like that. And it also is pretty doable. And you don't rush it, You don't rush it. You just work, You work until you get concentration. That's what I did my first 3 years of practice, right? Till I had pretty good concentration, and then some of this stuff starts to open up, but you don't rush it.
Yeah,
And you have skillful means that help you help us wind down one step at a time.
And just a quick observation, Stephen Batchelor, I heard, argue that emptiness really is the best translation of shunyata. And he believes that the Buddha chose the word shunyata deliberately to shock.
Yeah, it is, in English it's shocking. It's a kind of shocking word.
And the Buddha meant it to be, according to.
So he, according to Stephen Batchelor, it may have been shocking in the original language. Yeah, it was an ordinary word that it would be, you know, it was the word used when the Buddha says, when you meditate, like this is in the text of the Foundations of Mindfulness, go to an empty hut. That would be the word used. You know, so it's a very ordinary word. And it is kind of a shocking teaching. Again, like Guy Armstrong says, there's a certain weirdness to it being so central to a major world religion that, you know, emptiness, well, I mean, you know, it's not going to, they weren't, it wasn't going to be what the public relations advisor would suggest. Public, how about more about love or something more warm and fuzzy? Yeah, Peter, please.
I'm still a little confused about the practice of, say, metta, or your example of compassion, or the Brahmaparas as a whole, with this notion of winding down. You continue to wind down to, you know, to almost zero of these representations of construction.
Yeah.
How would you necessarily follow that you would be able to practice metta? I mean, doesn't that require a lot of conceptualization?
It's a good question. Where does metta come in? And you know, it's a very important question for our understanding. You know, without me talking about what I've talked about tonight, it's hard to understand. You know, because you know, it's basically about how wisdom and compassion go together. And you know, even at a very basic level, if the aim of mindfulness is to see the flow of experience carefully without really influencing it, just noticing it, and see everything as kind of an impersonal flow. What's metta about, where you wish for individual, and if the teachings are about not taking there be a solid self, well, metta seems to say, may Corey, may Mary be happy, right? So where does this really come in?
It almost assumes a priori that there's some skillful, some goodness, something there, that even with all of this, it's still going to be this residue.
There are different ways to look at it. And you know, I'm tracking the time. I would love to give a 5 or 10 minute response, but so I'm going to be a little bit brief. For one thing, I think there are more gross and more subtle ways of doing metta. Someone like Anālayo points to a non-conceptual radiating out of the heart as the form that actually is more likely to have been taught by the Buddha. The form that we have with phrases comes from, was sort of systematized about 1500 years later. So that's one way to look at it, that there can be ways, there can be more conceptual and less conceptual heart practices. There can be advanced metta practices where it's more radiating without concepts, and it actually takes one into non-dual territory. There also can be compassion practices which are similar, which are more advanced. There's also the perspective, and maybe I better finish with this thought and then go to the metta cards. There's also the perspective that even though, in a sense, a solid self is not quite what's there, it's illusory, the fact that beings believe that it's there means that one should respond to them. So there's a way of holding this more subtle wisdom view and still saying, these beings think that they're solid and independent. It's not true, but they think that, and they got caught in all sorts of suffering because of that. We need to help them. And so metta would be a form of helping them, and from that more advanced place, one helps them, one realizes that they think that they're solid, they're solid independent cells. We know that's not true, but we know that they're locked into that and it causes suffering. It'd be similar to as if you saw someone locked into some misunderstanding and that you knew it was off, but you still want to, you don't just tell the person, shape up. you meet them where they are, in other words, as a form of compassion. So those are two quick responses. It's a great question, though. It really is about how we unify wisdom and compassion, and it's a deep question. So thank you.